Well, here I am. I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody, too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd banish us, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public. Like a frog to tell one's name the livelong day to an admiring bug. How do you do? My name is Emily Dickinson. My sister Lavinia says I must warn you at the outset that my prose and my poetry tend to mingle a great deal. People sometimes lose their hats when the wind changes abruptly, so I'll ask you to please hold on to yours. I have lugged myself and this box downstairs, and I hope that you're properly appreciative, because this visit is an extraordinary event for me. I never see anyone from outside this household. I certainly never leave this house myself. No, my feet are as firmly rooted here as my plants are in the conservatory. I have agreed to see you here today because I have some matters to attend to with you. They concern unverified information from unidentified sources, usually spread by word of mouth. Rumors, yes. Oh, don't be alarmed. They're rumors about me, not about you. Now, first of all, now this one's really rather silly. I understand there is a fabrication abroad that I am a ghost. I am not a ghost. It's true I dress in white year-round, but I have a front and a back. And if you were to pinch me, which I shall not allow, you would feel flesh. And I would say, ouch. Some say that I am not a ghost, but that I'm a myth altogether. M-Y-T-H. Myth. Oh, I've even on occasion been referred to as a moth-like creature. M-O-T-H. Such nonsense. Can you imagine? It's a great disappointment to me, really. If people want to describe me, I do wish that they'd come up with a better simile than moth. A bird, perhaps. A lark. But a moth. I am not a ghost. I am not a myth. And I am most certainly not a moth. I am not surprised that people are curious about me. Well, since I'm mostly unknown to them. Oh, well. People will speculate about the unknown. The unknown is the greatest need of the intellect. Strange no one thinks to thank God for it. Still, they would be wiser to curb their speculations about me. For instance, the rumor that I am a woman of loose morals and crazy about men. Here in my seclusion? With whom do they think I carry on? The skeletons in the family closet? Oh, don't be alarmed. That's not the worst rumor. Not the worst that's been said about me, not by far. I will deal with the worst rumor later. In the meantime, I understand that some people think it strange I keep to my father's house. They wonder why I am a recluse. Well, there are reasons. For one thing, I have from time to time been beset by a bizarre variety of illnesses. I felt a cleaving in my brain as if my mind had split. I tried to match it seam by seam, but could not make them fit. The thought behind, I strove to join unto the thought before, but sequence raveled out of sound like balls upon a floor. I've suffered from excruciating headaches, reoccurring lung infections. Oh, my eyes have given me great pain. I spent long, dark months under the care of a Boston eye specialist. I feared I might go blind permanently. I lived on dread. It was not death, for I stood up, and all the dead lay down. It was not night, for all the bells put out their tongues for noon. It was not frost, for on my flesh I felt siroccos crawl, nor fire, for just my marble feet could keep a chancel cool. And yet it tasted like them all. The figures I have seen set orderly for burial reminded me of mine. And of course, in addition to the headaches and the eyes, the lung infections, there are dangers of the mind, and our pain so utter, it swallows substance up. Seclusion made explanation unnecessary. But more than the illnesses themselves, I cried at pity, not at pain. I heard a woman say, "Poor child," and something in her voice convicted me I can't abide pity. So I chose seclusion. Deprived of other banquet, I entertained myself. At first a scant nutrition, an insufficient loaf, but grown by slender addings to so esteemed a size, 'tis sumptuous enough for me, and almost to suffice. It's difficult, you see, because beneath the rumors and beneath the question about my seclusion is a larger question. Oh, yes. Oh, the great question. Who am I? Isn't this so? Who am I? Who are you? How do we know who we are? Very important question. Of course, you and I know that I am nobody. But I am a Dickinson, and in Amherst that counts for something. I'm one of the ninth generation of Dickinsons in this country. Oh, my ancestors were farmers, founders, models of Christian piety. My grandfather, Samuel Fowler Dickinson, founded Amherst Academy and Amherst College. The house where I live is called the Homestead. He built it. Yes, I spent my earliest years here. When I was little, growing up here, there was much training up the child in the way she should go on the part of the elders. Oh, don't misunderstand. They were kind. They were. But they were determined, nonetheless. I tried hard to be good, to mind the elders, not to make too much noise. Well, there were a lot of us, you see. My father, my mother, my big brother, Austin, my little sister, Lavinia, we shared this house with my grandfather, my grandmother, my aunts, cousins, uncles, and the servants. Well, you can imagine the rowdy if we got out of hand, which we sometimes did. I sometimes had to learn goodness
in a quiet closet if I got out of hand. It sounds cruel, I know, but really, I discovered something very important there. They shut me up in prose, as when a little girl they put me in the closet, because they liked me still. Still? Could themselves have peeped and seen my brain go round, they might as wise have lodged a bird for treason in the pound. Himself has but to will, and easy as a star abolishes captivity, and laugh. No more have I. To close one's eyes is travel. Captivity is consciousness. So is liberty. So much for closets. Oh, those days are long behind me now. I sometimes wish I were a child again, don't you? With all the warm feelings of home. All the hooks by the door loaded up, snug, frolicking. Oh, we had such good times. And school. Oh, yes, we have an excellent school here in Amherst. Amherst Academy, the one my grandfather founded. I was 9 when I enrolled in the academy, and it was like being admitted to heaven. I studied Latin, history, botany, English grammar, mental philosophy, geology, oh, social graces with Miss Woodbridge. Oh, we had fine teachers. Oh, I was always in love with my teachers. School was glorious. Oh, I've written a poem about school. Yes. We play at paste till qualified. Yes. I am using the word paste here in a special sense. It is, of course, the substance that we use to put papers, to glue papers together, but it's also the material that jewelers use to make imitation jewelry. So here. We play at paste till qualified for pearl, then drop the paste and deem ourselves a fool. The shapes, though, were similar, and our new hands learned gem tactics. Practicing sands. A poem about more than just school. The head of the school was Edward Hitchcock, a large, noble-looking man, a philosopher. You may remember him. Oh, a great man of science he was. He taught us all how to look at nature. What to look for. What to look for in the sky. What to look for in flowers. Oh, yes, all about the planets, their orbits, their perihelions. Do you know what the perihelion is? The perihelion is that place in the planet's orbit where it comes closest to its sun. Enchantment's perihelion, mistaken oft has been for the authentic orbit of its anterior sun. That means earthly pleasure has often been mistaken for heaven. Or school, or heaven. Oh, yes. Here, this blossom I will show you. Of one corolla is the west. The calyx is the earth. The capsule's burnished seeds, the stars. That's flaunting my first term botany. We learned from Mr. Hitchcock that everything deserves our observation, even the smallest, most common things, even the grass. Oh, I have a grass poem. I have a poem about most everything, and if I should die before I've dealt with all, it will be a mistake. Oh, yes, I'm telling you the grass poem. The grass so little has to do,
a sphere of simple green with only butterflies to brood and bees to entertain. And stir all day to pretty tunes the breezes fetch along. Hold the sunshine in its lap, bow to everything, and thread the dews all night like pearl, and make itself so fine a duchess were too common for such a noticing. And even when it die, to pass in odors so divine as lowly spices gone to sleep, or amulets of pine. And then to dwell in sovereign barns and dream the days away. The grass so little has to do. I wish I were a hay. Oh, I have another grass poem. Well, it's about a narrow fellow in the grass. Now, it's a riddle poem. You must figure out who the narrow fellow is. A narrow fellow in the grass occasionally rides. You may have met him, did you not? His notice sudden is. The grass divides as with a comb. A spotted shaft is seen, and then it closes at your feet and opens further on. He likes a boggy acre, a floor too cool for corn. Yet when a boy and barefoot, I more than once at noon have passed, I thought a whiplash unbraiding in the sun, when stooping to secure it, it wrinkled and was gone. Several of nature's people I know, and they know me. I feel for them a transport of cordiality, but never met this fellow, attended or alone, without a tighter breathing and zero at the bone. I owe a great deal to Mr. Hitchcock and his lessons about nature. I would say that childhood in Amherst was a very edifying process. Even our friendships were edifying. Oh, my friends were a great part of my world while I was growing up. Oh, by a root. Sarah Tracy, Abby Wood, Emmeline Kellogg, Emily Fowler. We practiced and practiced the arts of conversation, of verse-making, of music, and letter-writing. Oh, the art of letter-writing. Letter-writing, letter-receiving, letter-opening, letter-reading, letter-re-reading, letter-collecting, letter-sharing, letter-hiding, letter-sharing sometimes. Oh, a letter is the joy of earth. It is denied the gods. A letter always feels to me like immortality, because it is the mind alone without corporeal friend. I hold my friends the dearer for their fragileness, you know. Our house being on Main Street had full view of all the processions from church to cemetery. Those dark parades of tassels and of coaches. So many of my friends died young. These tested our horizon, then disappeared as birds before achieving a latitude. A retrospection of them, a fixed delight. But our anticipation, a dice, a doubt. So I take my stockings off, wading in the water. For the disobedient sake, boy who lived for order, went to heaven perhaps at death. And perhaps he didn't. Moses wasn't fairly used. Ananias wasn't. Death, striking sharp and early, gave me all for friends. Do you know what awe is? Awe is that place where thought and feeling lose words and stand barefoot in the presence. My chief happiness is finding words for thought. But the world of feelings leaves me like a reed shaken in the wind. Feelings to me have always been like the power of a volcano welling up inside and completely flooding over me. Volcanoes in school, we learned. Volcanoes be in Sicily and South America. I judge from my geography, volcanoes nearer here. A lava step at any time am I inclined to climb. A crater I may contemplate. Vesuvius at home. You know about Vesuvius, don't you? The volcano in Italy, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, had erupted and completely covered the city of Pompeii. Volcanoes be in Sicily and South America. I judge from my geography, volcanoes nearer here. A lava step at any time am I inclined to climb. A crater I may contemplate. Vesuvius at home. I had deep hopes for love, of course. Romantic love. Oh, yes. I've been in love several times. And I have been loved several times. Wild nights, were I with thee, wild nights should be our luxury. Futile the winds to a heart in port, done with a compass, done with a chart, rowing in Eden. Ah, the sea, might I but moor tonight in thee. You must forgive me. I will not tell you who. I will not tell you my stories. They are mine. Perhaps I could give you a love poem or so. Ah, yes. The rose did caper on her cheek. Her bodice rose and fell. Her pretty speech, like drunken men, did stagger pitiful. Her fingers fumbled at her work, her needle would not go. What ailed so smart a little maid? It puzzled me to know. Till, opposite, I spied a cheek that bore another rose. Just opposite, another speech that like the drunkard goes. A vest that like her bodice danced to the immortal tune. Till those two troubled little clucks ticked softly into one. A very curious thing, love. To lack of it is woe. To own of it is wound. Love comes before life. It continues after death. It is the source of all things, and the exponent of earth. It explains, interprets everything. That love is all there is all we know of love. It is enough the freight should be proportioned to the groove. How did we get to talking about love? Oh, yes, I asked, how is it we know who we are? Well, I will tell you one thing for certain. We can't ask other people. No. If I listened to other people, I would shrivel up completely. Squire Dickinson's half-cracked daughter, that's what they say. Oh, some say. I understand. There is a rumor that I am a snob. We all know what that is. God forbid. One of the most esteemed ladies in Amherst says that I'm an old maid, disappointed in love as a girl. My niece Martha says that other neighbors sometimes worry about me, that I'm here alone, perhaps wanting more things to do. More things to do. As if I were idle. I am not idle here. I bake the bread for Homestead. I've cared for Mother these invalid years. I hardly have time to think as it is. To me, the important thing is to be free from worrying about pleasing all those good people who think they know who I am. And I haven't even told you about the worst rumor yet. Oh, society is so distracting. I am nobody. There is a great freedom in being nobody. The soul selects her own society, then shuts the door on her divine majority, obtrude no more. Unmoved, she notes the chariots pausing at her low gate. Unmoved, an emperor be kneeling on her rush mat. I've known her from an ample nation, choose one. Then close the valves of her attention like stone. I've had to make a choice, you see. My country is truth. To experience the truths that lie all around us and within us, one must pay attention. Well, paying attention is a full-time job, I find. My sister Vinnie told someone the other day, Emily is the only one in the house whose job it is to think. To think. As something overtakes the mind. We do not hear it coming. Sometimes an idea will so possess me I can't contain its power. Here alone, I can keep the bright long enough to see what it's about. And then I can write. I write poems because with them I can select the word that closest reveals the essence of what I mean. And I can set it down on the page so that the meaning will break in the mind of the reader and flood through the being. To pile like thunder to its close, then crumble grand away, while everything created hid. This would be poetry. I reckon when I count at all, first poets, then the sun, then summer, then the heaven of God, and then the list is done. But looking back, the first so seems to comprehend the whole. The others look a needless show, so I write poets all. Their summer lasts a solid year. They can afford a sun the East would deem extravagant. And if the further heaven be beautiful as they disclose to those who worship them, it were too difficult a grace to justify the dream. I reckon when I count at all poets, it would be an even greater consummation to have readers. I do send some poems to friends in notes or with letters, but most of my poems I keep hidden. Trunks, dresser drawers. My best ones I keep here, in this box I brought downstairs with me. These are the ones. These poems are the ones I would publish if I were going to publish. Of course, publication is the prostitution of the mind of man, and far from my thought, but if I were to publish, these would be the ones. Oh, there was a time when I desperately wanted my poems to be published so all the world could read them, share them. Oh, the bright expectation of that April day. The Atlantic Monthly arrived at our house with an article by Thomas Wentworth Higginson, the great literary critic, you may know of him. Mr. Higginson had written inviting young writers to submit their work for publication. Well, this was the call I'd been waiting for, so I submitted. I spent days trying to find just the right poems to send him. I finally selected four, and off they went. Oh, I waited expectantly. And Mr. Higginson answered my letter. He said my meter was spasmodic, that I had bad rhymes, and that my poetry was uncontrolled. Uncontrolled. So much for publication. Would you like to hear the ones I sent him? Yes, I will read you the four poems that I sent to Mr. Higginson, and you can see what you think for yourselves. I know they're here somewhere in this box, tied with a black ribbon. Oh, yes, here they are. Actually, this top sheet is Mr. Higginson's letter. A bit of humility I keep tied to my pride. Discipline. Safe in their alabaster chambers, untouched by morning and untouched by noon, lie the meek members of the resurrection, rafter of satin and roof of stone. Grand go the years in the crescent above them, worlds scoop their arcs, firmaments row, diadems drop and doges surrender, soundless as dots on a disk of snow. I still find that quite a fine poem. Rather chilling, but a fine poem. Ah, yes, then here is another one. Oh, there's a word in here you may not know because you can't see it. The word is style, S-T-I-L-E, not the word meaning fashion.
It's the kind of style that's a double step ladder going over a fence. One side going up, the other side going down. I'll tell you how the sun rose. A ribbon at a time. The steeples swam in amethyst. The news like squirrels ran. The hills untied their bonnets. The bobolinks begun. Then I said softly to myself, that must have been the sun. But how he set, I know not. There seemed a purple stile that little yellow boys and girls were climbing all the while, till when they reached the other side, a dominie in grey put gently up the evening bars and led the flock away. The third poem is... The third poem I sent Mr. Higginson is one you know. We play at paste till qualified for pearl, then drop the paste and deem ourselves a fool. The shapes, though, were similar, and our new hands learned gem tactics practicing sands. Oh, yes, Mr. Higginson was very clear in pointing out to me that the words pearl and fool don't rhyme. Now, finally, oh, yes, this poem. Oh, this has an uncommon word. This next one has an uncommon word in it. I love obscure words, don't you? I use them a lot. Not to confuse people, mind you, but because we sometimes sense most clearly what we perceive from the corner of our eye. Yes, the word here is pinace. Now, a pinace is a kind of a carriage. It's spelled P-I-N-N-A-C-E. And in this poem, it's used to refer to the body of the bee. The nearest dream recedes, unrealized. The heaven we chase, like the June bee before the schoolboy invites the race, stoops to an easy clover, dips, evades, teases, deploys, then to the royal clouds lifts its light pinnace. Heedless of the boy, staring bewildered at the mocking sky, homesick for steadfast honey. Ah, the bee flies not that broods that rare variety. A bee, you will note, not a moth. Spasmodic meter indeed. Bad rhymes. Uncontrolled, how can he? Well, all in all, I believe Mr. Higginson was simply not ready to have anyone disobey the rules and regulations set down for poetry by others. My feeling is, who says a poem must look just so on a page, or be measured out in only certain rhymes and lines and meters? It's not the way life comes to me. It's not the way the poem comes to me. You must forgive me. I don't mean to be unruly or to give offence, but I can only give what is mine, what I have to give. I'm sorry Mr. Higginson didn't like it. So you see, I have not been successful in getting my poems published. Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. To comprehend a nectar requires sorest need. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today can tell the definition so clear of victory. victory as he defeated, dying. On whose forbidden ear the distant strains of triumph burst agonized and clear. Actually, 7 of my poems have been published, but they were all doctored, fixed up to look right to the editor. To me, they were almost unrecognizable. Thomas Niles, the editor of A Mask of Poets, you may know the book. It has many poems in it without the names of the authors, so that it's open to anyone to guess who the author is. Well, he published my successes counted Swedish, and strictly not without my permission. He made no less than 6 changes in my poem. He wrote, "Success is counted sweetest by those that ne'er succeed." It's not a that, it's a person. It's who ne'er succeed. He wrote, "To comprehend the nectar," it's not a particular nectar, it's any nectar. "To comprehend," it should be "to comprehend a nectar," "requires the sorest need," he wrote, "the sorest need," instead of just "requires sorest need." And in the next verse he made a change. "Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today can tell the definition so plain of victory," he wrote, instead of "so clear of victory." And in the last line he wrote, "As he defeated, dying, on whose forbidden ear the distant strains of triumph break agonizing clear," he wrote, instead of "my burst agonized and clear." Everyone thought it had been written by Ralph Waldo Emerson. It's not fair, you know, very disheartening. I wrote it the way I wanted it. And I'll tell you something, in spite of what I said about publication earlier, I do hope my poems will some day be published and that people will read them the way I wrote them. I hope so. I do hope so. Hope is the subtle glutton that feeds upon the fair. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me. You may wonder why I continue to write, since nobody reads my poems. I will tell you. I found a warbler on a bush down at the foot of the garden. "Why sing," I said, "since nobody hears?" "My business is to sing," she said, and away she rose. "My business is to sing. What difference does it make if nobody listens? I must sing. I find ecstasy in living. The mere sense of living is joy enough. Take all away from me, but leave me ecstasy." To be alive is power. Existence in itself, without a further function. Omnipotence enough. We are still left with that question about how it is we know who we are, aren't we? I will tell you what I think. I think life is a continuous discovery. But, oh, there is still much mystery to me, much wondering, much wonder. You know what wonder is? Wonder is not precisely knowing, and not precisely knowing not. A beautiful but bleak condition. He has not lived, who has not felt. Well, I've wandered far from the rumors, I'm afraid. And I must now settle that worst rumor I mentioned to you earlier. I'm going to read you a few choice selections from my box. I heard a fly buzz when I died. Notice. This is not a poem about a moth. It's about a fly. It's not really about a fly either, but there is a fly in it. I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. The eyes around had wrung them dry, and breaths were gathering firm for that last onset when the king be witnessed in the room. I willed my keepsakes, signed away what portion of me be assignable, and then it was there interposed a fly with blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me, and then the windows failed, and then I could not see to see. The second poem. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly rode. He knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure too for his civility. We passed the school where children strove at recess in the ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling of the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice in the ground. Since then 'tis centuries, yet each field shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity. Now, the final one in this group is one I wrote years ago about hearing a young... after hearing a young man sing a song. He stood by the piano and sang about dying for his lost love and mouldering in his grave. I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb when one who died for truth was lain in an adjoining room. He questioned softly why I failed. For beauty, I replied, and I for truth. Themself are one, we brethren are, he said. And so, as kinsmen met a night, we talked between the rooms until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our names. There, well, now that's enough of that. I am sure you noticed they were all about death. The worst rumor is that I am the death poet. The death poet? Isn't that appalling? Appalling, actually. I've written only 200 or so poems about death. Well, since I've written over 1,700, it seems a modest amount to me. Death is, you must admit, a fascinating side of life. A ceaseless cause for speculation. Oh, it's such a great unknown. I have to my credit, however, a good 1,600 poems about the many other facets of life, and I believe that they put me securely on the wholesome side of things. Just because I've written a few poems about death does not mean that I am obsessed, and it does not mean that I am out of my mind. Although much madness is divinest sense to a discerning eye. Much sense, the starkest madness. Oh, dear. Oh, excuse me a moment. Oh, I must write that. Much madness is divinest sense to a discerning eye. Much sense the... What did I say? Sheerest nonsense. That's not quite right. Much madness is divinest sense. Sheerest nonsense. 'Tis the majority in this as all prevail. Agree and you are sane. Disagree. Oh, that's not. Yes. Assent and you are sane. Demur. You're straightway. Dangerous. And manacled with a chain. Yes. Manacled, that's good. Handcuffed. Handcuffed is good, too. Handcuffed, handled. Perhaps I'll have to come back to this later. This is a rough draft, but... Much madness is divinest sense to a discerning eye. Much sense, the starkest madness. 'Tis the majority in this, as all, prevail. Assent, and you are sane. Demur, you're straightway dangerous and handled with a chain. There. The beginnings of a new poem. And not one word about death. Or moths. So much for rumors. There, now... Well, I believe that settles it. You've been very kind to come and to let me set the record straight about all of these rumors, and to let me share some of my poems with you. And so thank you, and goodbye. And, oh yes, if anyone should ask you about your visit with Emily, please... Tell them this was a poet. Just a poet. Not a death poet. This was a poet. It is that distills amazing sense from ordinary meanings, and attar so immense from the familiar species that perished by the door. We wondered it was not ourselves arrested it before. This was a poet. Thank you. Oh, yes, and please, not a moth-like creature either. Thank you.